Rave Radio. All right, everybody, welcome back to another edition of AV Insider. Your host, me, as always, Johnny here, and some undisclosed location in Northern California. Today, I have my good friend, Rich Jackson, who has been in the industry well over 35 years and has seen a lot of things change, and kind of nothing really changes if you think about it. Before I get a little more descriptive about what Rich is all about and where he's been and what's going on, as always, I'd like to thank my sponsors. We have Hypersign, maker of fine digital signage solutions. And if you guys are commercial integrators, you should really consider at least looking into digital signage. It's everywhere you go. It's when you go to the airport, it's there. When just pretty much everywhere. Like when I drive down the highway, all the signs are being replaced by digital signs. So check them out. They're at hypersign.com. And Atlas Sound, who has been around forever, manufacturers of speakers, racks, cables, amplifiers, and all the stuff that we're integrating to every day. They are at atlassound.com. Now, Rich Jackson, like I said, is a good friend of mine here in the Bay Area, but has been around through, I would say at least the last 35 years. And I think he started back in 1970 at Pacific Stereo and College for Recording Arts in San Francisco, selling pro audio gear to Bay Area studios. I mean, he's got a really extensive list of from the beginning of really hi-fi stuff and kind of just seeing things evolve. So rather than me kind of telling the story, I have him on the show today. And let's talk a little bit of that. Rich, thank you for being here.
And thank you for the opportunity, Johnny.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about, like I said, you've been around in the AV industry well longer than I've probably thought about it.
Good news, bad news. It's more than 35 years. It's been 43 years of August.
Okay, and, I was kind of close.
Yeah, kind of close. but I don't, that scares me. And the nice thing is I've always done what I loved. And I probably when I was, 14 or 15 years old, and in the mid-60s, mid-60s, I really developed an interest around audio. And that's when stereo was just beginning. And the first hi-fi system, serious hi-fi system, was a Fisher integrated amplifier, X100C, using EL34, which is an output tube. And how I remember that, I'm not sure, but I had AR4 speakers, I had a AR turntable with a Shure M3D cartridge, and I got hooked at an early age. So my feeling was I was going to go to work for a stereo store, Pacific Stereo, and that's where I did most of my shopping for my gear, and take advantage of the employee accommodation, buy the gear I wanted, which was Macintosh and JBL, and then continue on and get a real job. Well, here we are in 2013, and I'm still very involved with the audio industry, but now as a manufacturer's representative, dealing with some what I consider high-value, high-performance lines. And I'm pretty selective in terms of what I sell. Back when I first purchased my audio gear, stereo radios were just beginning to happen. And I remember having to add an additional modulator to create stereo radio. And growing up in Lafayette, in the suburbs of Lafayette, we were out in the valley, and so we had a 40-foot mast antenna for our television, and I got minimal FM reception, but I remember the early days of stereo on radio, which Jim Gabbert, who went on to start Channel 20, was pretty much a pioneer in that whole arena. And to this day, I remember listening to albums, the Doors, and the Young Rascals, and getting goosebumps. And to this day, you know, listen to my audio system this morning, which is much better than what I had back then. It's based around Bryston, which is one of the lines I represent. And, you know, everything now is stored on a hard drive. So, you know, the process has changed over the years. It started out as analog. And there was no choice. You know, tubes were the only option. I remember when I first bought my separate components, I was looking at Marantz, and Marantz at that time was manufactured in the U.S., and it was a very high-end manufacturer, as was Macintosh, and they had two preamps available. They had a 7C, and the 7C was tube, and then they had the 7T, which is transistor. I ended up buying a Macintosh C26 and a Mac 2100 amplifier, and built my own speakers, and that really is where I began in the industry. I worked for Pacific Stereo for a couple of years. I went to a trade school of sorts, College for Recording Arts. I became very adept in terms of consoles, analog tape machines, running 2-inch tape. Shortly after my 2 years at College for Recording Arts, I went to work for Sound Genesis, which was one of the early pro audio dealers in San Francisco. And really, we had three divisions. We had a educational division, we had a broadcast division, and a studio division. And I was responsible for all the recording studios in Northern California, most of which were in the city. And, you know, back in the early 70s, San Francisco was absolutely a mecca for recording. The energy and the material that was coming out was pretty amazing. I'm hoping that we'll see a renaissance like that again. I really haven't seen that in my lifetime, but I have seen some very significant changes. I remember my first experience with digital was in the early 1980s, and I think Yamaha was the first CD player that I sold. It was $1,000. It was called a CD1, and early generation CD players were not highly regarded. They were a little bit striking in terms of sound quality. The first digital recorder was actually utilized a VHS cassette, and that was a Technics digital recorder. And I learned a lesson. In the digital domain, zero means zero. And recording analog, you would always go beyond zero because you want to make sure that the noise floor, the music is above the noise floor. So it was an absolute awakening for me as we got into the digital arena. When I worked in Berkeley, and I spent 18 years working in Berkeley at a higher end retailer on Telegraph Avenue, and that was also the beginning, early days of surround sound. Actually, 4-channel made its first appearance in the early 70s, and it was surround sound. It was four channels. It was done by a matrix system. There was one discrete system, but it was never successful because it wasn't tied into film. It was strictly for music, and it never really happened. It's, I think, somewhat analogous to 3D on the video side. I don't think that's really been fully adopted.
Did you say that was in the 70s?
And this is in the 70s, and I remember Marantz was the first to come out with these 4-channel surround sound receivers. But it was weird because, you know, a good audio system is two speakers, and you want the two speakers then to create a soundstage. And that soundstage has three dimensions. It has height, width, and depth, if it's a well-designed, good quality system. And in the early days of surround sound, all of a sudden you'd have different instruments coming from behind you, and it was, you know, it was more of a distraction. It had good potential, but I don't think it was utilized properly. I don't think the engineers really understood what the heck they were doing. It went away, and then multi-channel then resurfaced in the early 80s as, you know, video became a vital part of audio. And that was, you know, Advent was the first manufacturer. It was a two-piece video projection system. Gosh, it probably, I can't remember what it sold for, but probably $7,000 or $10,000. It had a curved screen. The projector were three CRT tubes or guns. Probably had about 200 ANSI lumen brightness. So you needed a curved screen. You needed a very dark room. The early players on the surround sound side were Fosgate. They were probably the best regarded. And all of a sudden, Dolby got involved. And we then really had something that was more cohesive. And we had, you know, left, right with a phantom center, because it was a four-channel system. And then we had two surround speakers. And the surround speakers are really were much more for effect music rather than, you know, direct instruments or direct music.
Yeah, kind of.
And, you know, Dolby was absolutely, I mean, Dolby was very instrumental in a number of areas. You know, in the early days, the audio cassettes were very popular, and the cassette was developed by Philips in the early 60s, and it was running at a very slow speed, and it was designed for voice only. And what allowed it then to become viable for music, and for many years cassettes were very viable, and Nakamichi being kind of the premier manufacturer of cassette decks, was the Dolby noise reduction. And Ray Dolby you know, developed perceptual audio coding. His background was microscopes, and he developed noise reduction for these big microscopes looking into deep space because there was a lot of noise. So he developed an algorithm to help reduce that noise, and then he brought it down, he dumbed it down, if you will, and then provided that in the audio world. Originally is Dolby A for recording studios, and then Dolby B for consumer cassette decks. The first cassette deck to utilize Dolby actually was an Advent cassette deck, and then soon after that, Harman Kardon incorporated Dolby. And then from that point forward, Nakamichi actually was the OEM manufacturer for those machines. Shortly thereafter, the whole world of cassettes became very strong, and people were, you know, kind of like what people are doing with MP3s now, or what they're doing with CDs, they're doing compilations, pretty much disregarding the, you know, the copyright or the, you know, the royalties that are due the artists. But it was a, you know, very, very strong venue in terms of compilation of different songs. To this day, you know, virtually every CD slash album I have, there's only one or two songs that, you know, are really valuable. There's just a lot of stuff that's required by the studios. And, you know, I will buy an album for, you know, one song. You know, and Apple kind of changed that whole world by allowing individual songs to be sold.
Right. So now we're fast forwarding to more modern times when the digital era kind of really, like you said, Apple now sells, I mean, obviously iTunes, right? You can go buy a song for 99 cents. And for most people, how easy is that?
Well, it, you know, it was very easy, but the, you know, all of a sudden, rather than selling 10 or 12 pieces of music on a piece of vinyl, and having a, you know, a complete experience, because album art to this day is still valuable. And, you know, in my iTunes collection, I make sure all of the art is correct. It's high resolution, so it looks good on my iPad. But, you know, when people were able to buy individual songs, it kind of threw the recording industry into a quandary. So an artist, rather than making $5 or $6 on an album, all of a sudden was making, you know, 75 cents on an individual song.
Right.
So,
but also, you know, in terms of, we talked about this on the show the other day, is that convenience, what they're doing now is kind of sacrificing the quality of the audio that people can easily conveniently buy, you know, for the click of a dollar or whatever you want to, you know, people sell it for, especially on iTunes. We're talking about MP3 audio versus, you know, fully uncompressed analog audio on vinyl, which, you know, like I said, when everything was, you know, 30, 40 years ago, there wasn't a choice. You couldn't just go to online and just download a song. You were buying full albums and experiencing the whole album. You couldn't just pick, you know, I really like this one song. I can't just go get that one track, you know.
And you could, but it was a real nuisance because you have to, you know, pick up the tone arm and one blank groove to another. So it wasn't particularly convenient.
Yeah, but I meant, like, it's not like we were able to, like, you know, back then or even now, because it's still sell vinyl every day and press it every day. It's not like you could have gone in and said, you know what, I want to hear that one song, and then say, you know, go down the record store, yeah, I listened to, you know, this Beatles album, and then, like, I really wanted to hear this one track, so I'm just going to buy that one track. You couldn't just do that unless it was, like, an EP or something.
Well, or a 45.
Right, or a 45, yeah.
45 had two sides, and it had an A side, which is the one they expected to sell, and a B side, which usually was a secondary or tertiary song. But sometimes record companies were surprised because the B side actually got more play than the A side. So,
right.
You know, Apple is, you know, Apple and Fraunhofer. Fraunhofer is an optics company based in France. I think they're France, but somewhere in Europe. And Fraunhofer was the company that originally came up with a codec, the compression codec for MP3, of which you have a variety of compression ratios. And then they co-invented AAC with Apple Computer, because Tony Fadell was hired. He had a concept of having a handheld device that could hold a bunch of music. And he was the one that came out with he was responsible for the first seven generations of iPods, and then he evolved and was responsible for the first couple of generations of iPhones. He's 42 years old. He's done very well in his life. But the whole idea back, I still have a Gen 1 iPod, and it was 5 gigabytes of storage space. So if I wanted a lot of music on there, then I had to use heavily compressed music. So, 128 kilobits per second. But, you know, I would compromise the sound quality, because at 128 kilobits per second, it only represents, you know, about 7% of all the content that's in the music. And what they tried to do, what Ray Dolby tried to do, is through perceptual audio coding, is disregard, you know, what you didn't hear. Because when the music gets loud, there's music behind it, but you're going to hear what's louder. So take away that stuff that's behind it. And, you know, to me, my big learning experience was Napster. It was all MP3. I downloaded all sorts of stuff, and I felt kind of guilty because I was bypassing the artist. I downloaded all this content at 128 kilobits per second, and I realized that's not a particularly good bit rate. And
but most people don't even know that. Like, I would say, you know, so now that we're in the digital era, or have been for quite a bit, like when you were saying, you know, you have Gen 1 iPod, for, you know, some of the younger kids listening now, you couldn't even get that. The closest thing you could get is like an iPod Classic. And I think those are like, you know, up to like...
It's 160.
Right.
160 gigabits.
Right.
I have my entire collection. I have about 500 CDs, and I've ripped them all to Apple Lossless.
Okay.
And I can put that entire collection on, iPod Classic. You know, and I have one that I carry in my car, and I have one in my office. I have one down in my main two-channel area, my demo area, because my home doubles as a showroom. And, you know, I show virtually every streaming venue available, you know, including airport expresses and being able to stream off an airport express, AirPlay, where I can stream off iPad or my iPhone.
You've got a pretty good mix of analog meets new school and digital era.
Well, and that's my, as a manufacturer's rep, that's my job. I need to know more or be a resource to the customers that I serve. So not only that, but I'm a gadget guy and I like buying this stuff. And because I have a rep company, it's a business deduction. So, I mean, it's a win-win situation.
Right.
So, what I find happening is, my most recent purchase was a turntable. I had gotten rid of my turntable. I'm not sure when, but, I'd gone, everything was stored on a computer and I was using iTunes as the interface. I still think it's a good interface. And was listening to this content at 128 kilobits per second, streaming through either my request box or my Mac mini computer. And I realized that the image wasn't quite right, and it didn't have the fullness that I was able to realize playing the analog or the vinyl equivalent.
Right.
So Napster actually is responsible for me going out and duplicating my entire vinyl collection, because by the time I figured out that I needed a higher bit rate, Napster was shut down, and they should have been shut down. Because they were screwing the artist in terms of getting their royalties.
Right, and there's other places where people still currently do.
Oh yeah, and that's peer-to-peer, but I don't want to have my computer vulnerable to someone else's computer,
right, exactly.
Yeah, it's unprotected sex, if you will,
The digital version of that, exactly.
What I'm seeing is, we've gone full circle. I represent a line of tube electronics that are very affordable. It's Prima Luna. It's manufactured by a high-end engineer in the Netherlands, it's designed in the Netherlands, manufactured in China to very, very high quality standards. I mean, China has the ability of building whatever quality you want. And then it's distributed through Upscale Audio in Southern California. And at this juncture, they now have a complete dealer network and they have a rep network in place. And I'm seeing over the last 3 years that I've been the Prima Luna rep, I'm seeing very predictable, consistent growth, because there's kind of a resurgence in interest in tubes. And I'm seeing, KFOG has Live from the Archives, which they've been doing for the last 16 or 17, 18 years. And it is traditionally always been on CD. They now release Live from the Archives on vinyl. So, I say, everything changes and nothing changes. People now are coming back and realizing that there's a higher level of quality with tube electronics and analog sources. And that analog source most likely will come from a turntable, but there are people that still have reel-to-reel tape decks out there, quarter-inch tape that run at 7.5 or 15 inches per second with content. And, I see a significant opportunity, but it requires education, because if someone's only experience is an iPod at 128 kilobits per second, they don't know any better. But if they have an opportunity to go somewhere, and thank goodness there are a number of brick and mortar stores in Northern California to where people can go and they can listen to a compressed file, and then they can listen to that same song played off a piece of vinyl through tube electronics. And the difference is, quite honestly, significant.
Right.
But it is really a matter of education.
We kind of talked about this when I talked to some other people in the past about, like, I see a big movement again. Like we're talking about, you know, like you said, you know, everything's changed, you know, from analog, and it went through this digital phase, which we're still in, but it's kind of coming full circle to coming back to analog and hi-fi. And I've seen a lot of the hi-fi manufacturers kind of putting out some, I wouldn't say like low quality, but like not their highest end product, making it more affordable for the younger generation who are the, you know, the digital era, in hopes that they buy this product and able to be educated, and once their ear kind of matures and then they get older, will then become, you know, like full line customers of their natural product that we all know, but they may not have had a chance to even know about until recently because of this product that they're putting out.
Well, I think there's more awareness. Neil Young has been on this big time bandwagon for the last 3 years, and he has three codecs that he's developed, which are high-resolution codecs called Pono. And, you know, sadly, he was in conversations with Steve Jobs. Never met with Steve Jobs, because Steve Jobs passed away before he was able to meet with him. You know, Apple, there's been a significant amount of speculation that Apple will provide higher-resolution content. They hired Tom Holman, who back, we talked about this earlier today, Tom Holman started, Apt Holman built preamps in the late 70s, and then was hired by George Lucas to develop the THX specification, and that was for commercial movie theaters, and then it dropped down into the consumer product. And the speculation is, and then Tom Holman went on and was a full-time professor at USC and started Odyssey, which is a room correction product. Odyssey is incorporated in most of the receivers.
I'm wearing their shirt right now.
And Odyssey is probably the most commonly adopted. I know Integra, Onkyo, Denon, major receivers have Odyssey. And it's great because, you know, you set up a surround system, you put a microphone at the kind of the average listening level, and push a button, and everything balances the way it should.
Right.
So it's, you know, a, you know, 5-minute setup process rather than using, I still have an old Radio Shack SBL meter, and, you know, rather than having to put tones in and raising and lowering those tones looking at a meter, it's a lot easier just placing this calibrated mic and pushing a button. So,
right.
Being very quiet at the same time.
Right.
You can create some problems if you make too much noise. So, I'm gratified to see this kind of this revitalization and re-interest in analog technology, and, you know, slowly but surely, you know, as people become educated, and I think a lot of the blogs and a lot of the, you know, Consumer Electronics Association, you know, video now is at high resolution. It's a 4K resolution. Audio becomes higher resolution, and I think the two, you know, there's a good chance that the video will educate people to, you know, it's very easy to tell the difference between, you know, 480p versus, you know, 1080p. You know, there's a significant difference. I mean, it's immediate.
Right.
And what we need to do is be able to create venues to show the difference between 128 kilobits per second and maybe 8824, which is kind of the standard high-res recording format that's utilized in recording studios today. And, you know, the whole recording process is changed. I used to sell these big tape machines, two inch tape with 16 tracks, and now, you know, you can buy a MacBook with Pro Tools and pretty much create what would have cost, you know, $20,000 or $30,000 to create, and actually have plug-in effects that cost $20 and come up with some very impressive recordings.
Right. So now the digital era, like you're talking about, is now producing this hi-fi audios for the younger generation.
Well, and therein lies the challenge is, once someone experiences it, then they have the opportunity to appreciate it, and hopefully they have the ability to afford it.
Right, because it's not always an
easy you buy an iPod for, $179, and it comes with a pair of earbuds.
Right.
And, you know, that's easy. Right. But all of a sudden, even with a line like Prima Luna, which is very affordable, relatively speaking, when it comes to tube electronics, you know, if you get a good quality audio system, you're looking at about $12,000.
Right.
Then you have to worry about your sources. And, you know, my primary source is a Mac Mini, a new generation Mac Mini. I use a Bryston DAC, new generation DAC. I use an asynchronous input. And then I use Audio Verana, which is a piece of software that strips all the stuff that the Apple wants to put in the path of the music. And, you know, I'm listening to, you know, 44, 48, 16K content. And I tell you, it sounds really good. And I go and I use my iPad, and it works within the iPad interface. And I like, you know, it's a great iTunes interface, and it's, you know, very intuitive, and it's a great way to manage your music, great way to access your music. So
it's a good example of, like I said, new digital mix with newish old analog amplification and sound purification, if you will.
Well, yeah, and it's very interesting, because if you look at the pro audio world, or you look at Fender amplifiers, you know, I don't know how long Fender's been in business, probably since 1950, they have always provided, you know, a Fender guitar amp that has tubes.
Right.
You know, because tubes typically will have a lower power rating, but you can push tubes well beyond their, you know, rated power, and the distortion is very pleasant. People don't know it's distortion. With a solid-state amplifier, you push it beyond its limits, and you create a square wave, and it's very objectionable distortion. You just can't listen to it. Not only that, but when you're producing a square wave, then you have the chance of ruining your speakers, because speakers don't like that type of distortion. It can be very harmful. And square waves also produces secondarily a lot of heat, and it will take out a tweeter or a mid-range pretty quickly. So anyway, it's been a very interesting ride for me to see this whole thing in 43 years come full circle. And it's, you know, part of my goal as a manufacturer's rep is to educate the accounts that I deal with, and I'm fortunate I probably deal with 250 integrators and or brick and mortar stores in this territory, including Hawaii. And, you know, I want them then in turn to go out and, you know, sell up and let people know that there are better quality, better quality solutions available. And that's the challenge. I also mentioned I was at a SEMTI meeting at Meyer Sound Lab, and you know, the guys that invented the MP3 were there, and obviously they want to justify MP3. So, you know, I'm seeing it at both extremes. There are guys that, you know, want to promote MP3, and you know, get a lot of content on a fairly small storage medium, and then on the other side, studios, Neil Young, you know, high-end audio manufacturers are doing their best to get people into higher resolution, higher quality music. It's a better experience.
Right, and there is. And so for a lot of people that don't know, I mean, you don't have to buy an MP3. There are places where you can get high quality audio like HDTracks.com and things
and
like that.
And right now, HDTracks, the new highest resolution format is now called DSD. And DSD essentially is, Sony developed something called an SACD, which was very high resolution music on a shiny disc, looked like a CD. Sony is no longer doing SACD, but the file format that was created, those songs the format is a DSD format. So we're now seeing vehicles, and they're online download vehicles, because everything is online downloadable, streamable. You know, gosh, I was just reading Netflix is talking about doing 4K content. You know, I read that yesterday. But then we have a big bottleneck. It's going to have everything to do with bandwidth coming into your house, you know, because you need to be able to stream at a certain speed and a certain amount of content, you know, to realize the benefits of 4K. So anyway, it's, you know, I think slowly but surely people will become educated. There'll be more online resources. DSD, I'm not sure what the future of that is, because you need special software, you know, special circuitry to play that format back. But it's moving in the right direction, just like video is going higher and higher resolution. Audio is going higher and higher resolution. And one very easy way of doing that is pulling out an LP and putting it on a turntable and playing it through a tube amplifier through a good pair of speakers, you know, here we go again, you know, right back to the beginning.
Back to the beginning.
Yeah.
But even still, like, what you're doing, so, like, I guess, well, yeah, I want to say digital, like, is your Bryson DAC, is that tube or is that electronic?
No, everything that Bryson makes is transistor, solid
transistor
state.
Transistor, yeah, okay.
You know, it was interesting because, you know, I was around when solid state transistors were first used in amplifiers, and first generation transistor amplifiers were terrible. JBL, James B. Lansing, was one of the first manufacturers, and they built them in Southern California. They had an SA660, it was an integrated amp, and they sold most of them to Japan. JBL was still a very, very, you know, a big line to the Japanese. And the transistors were made out of geranium. And unbeknownst to the designers, geranium would deteriorate after 2 or 3 years. And then they moved over, and then they started using silicon. And silicon has been, you know, the choice of chips, you know, since, I don't know, 73, 74. Everything now is silicon based. And, you know, the amount of circuitry that can be put on a small chip is pretty scary. You know, you look at the little processor in an iPhone or in, you know, an iPad, you know, that has more processing power than a Cray computer had in 1970. And the Cray computer, you know, took up half a block, you know? So, and it's interesting because Cray computer now is making a comeback because they make these supercomputers that essentially fill an auditorium, but, you know, people want to be able to crunch bigger and more numbers. So it's kind of nice to see that the Cray is making a comeback. You know, it's, you know, I think all of this is somewhat analogous and parallel. You know, in terms of seeing names that kind of went away that are making a comeback. I drive on 101 on a regular basis, and back in the day, Ampex owned the magnetic tape world, and the Pro 456 tape was the standard in recording studios, and Ampex still has their sign out on 101 in Redwood City, you know, and it's kind of fun. I have no idea what they do, But the sign is still up, and it's a gentle reminder of simpler days and, you know, the days of analog. So,
Definitely the return or the rise and return of hi-fi is kind of a big portion of where we're at and headed in the last few years, I think.
Yeah, well, and what's allowing that is, you know, I see now terabyte drives, you know, SATA drives for $49 on, you know, tigerdirect.com.
Yeah,
so
very inexpensive.
Your storage is, and you know, I've got all sorts of, I got 40 gigabytes of online storage with my iTunes account, not iTunes, my iCloud account, and I have multiple, you know, iPads and, you know, Apple products, and they all sync to, you know, my storage online. So I don't have to be dependent on the computer if in fact I need to do a restore, and the reality is periodically I have to do restores, you know.
Now, we'll talk a little bit more back to the digital version. So you have it all like iCloud and backed up. Do you use, like, when you do a demo, other than, like, let's say, we, you know, as simple as, you know, analog, vinyl, turntable, tube amp, and then the DAC, play through some really nice speakers. When you do the digital format, I know you have tracks stored on your, like, your Mac Mini and things like that. Do you ever do, like, a digital site and stream it straight from them, or is it all music that you have stored? Like, a lot of people will fight over, like, you know, saying who has the best stream rate.
It's funny because Pandora is in Oakland, and four of their engineers were over here about 4 months ago.
Oh, really?
Because they're building a new room, and they want the room to be really clean. So there's a table, a keyboard, and then a 65-inch plasma on a wall, and they have invisible speakers. I do stealth acoustics. So the integrator or the consultant on the project, a longtime friend, said, you guys should use invisible speakers. So you know, walk into the room, and before they upload content to their server, they'll have the A&R person from the record company come in and make sure that the album art and the liner note and all the content is correct before they upload it. So it's kind of fun. But, you know, I don't stream. I will stream on a background basis from Radio Time if I'm entertaining in my dining room. I have a Mac Mini, and I have a, you know, 46-inch Sony display. So, you know, I had Vince over from Totem Acoustics for dinner a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So I went on Radio Time and I found a jazz station from Montreal. So as we're eating dinner, Vince is listening to a local radio station. That's kind of fun. But you know, the intent really was not for maximum fidelity. It was just for background music.
Yeah, and speaking of Vince, I'm actually emailing him and Stephen Libin to try and get him on the show here pretty soon.
Yeah, Vince is absolutely passionate. You know, he was a math teacher by trade and always just had this incredible burning desire to build over-the-top speaker, and he's done very well. Totem makes a great product.
And I always tell people my story, like, every, you know, when I met Vince at your house, and I'm thankful that you invited me to come over. He's just an amazing guy. You know, the first time I was, you know, I was really blown away, I think, by hi-fi, and, like, with their speakers, because there's, you know, he's all about these tiny drivers that sound like it's a much larger, you know, like, floor-standing speaker or much larger driver in comparison. And I was at CES probably 5 or 6 years ago, and I just happened to stumble, like, in one of the hotel, like, lobby rooms and in a room, and, you know, I had kind of had no idea at the time, you know, I'm a younger kid and didn't really get it yet. And, you know, and I thought I'd kind of just step in and check out, you know, what demo was going on. And I was just blown away by, like, the clarity of the speakers and the amount of, like, bass. It was kind of, like, just kicking up my chest. But to my surprise, there was no subwoofer. It was just two-channel audio coming out of these tiny in-wall, that they still make today, their in-wall Tribe speakers.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just blown away, and like, and so, you know, to this day I still love them very much, and they have, you know, their new line, the Kin line of those speakers and such. But
no, it's you know, it you know, we need to be, you know, very sensitive to design. Aesthetics become more and more important, so yeah. If you could have a low profile speaker, floor standing speaker, you're good. If you could have a ceiling speaker that looks like a number 8 lighting fixture, like a James SA7,
yep.
If you have need to go with an invisible speaker, you know, it's just you know, kind of the way that we need to deal with the needs of any given designer or customer.
And that's kind of like, again, like with Apple, like what they did. They gave everyone a beautiful design and something that works, and it just, you know, it's quality, right? I mean, like, not necessarily the MP3 per se, but they're the device, you know, it's simple to use and it's nice.
I'll take it one step further. It's every part of the experience, from buying it to unpacking it to using it, the experience is absolutely through the roof.
Right.
And that, to me, is what it's all about. And you know, Steve Jobs apparently was a challenging guy, but he was fanatical about the experience.
The experience, right.
You know, quite honestly, I don't think he was in it for the money. I think he was in it because he wanted to provide a better experience.
I don't think he needed money.
And guess what? The money followed. You know?
Right,
and,
right.
You know, I try to align myself with customers and manufacturers that have similar philosophies. They're in it because they want to do a better job and they want to provide a superior experience. And the top integrators that I deal with, you know, including your boss, you know, he's motivated by, you know, taking good care of his customers. You know?
Right. Should so, be, yeah. Make
and that's
happy.
Where it should be, you know.
Provide
so,
a solid solution.
Anyway, that's my soapbox. So.
Well, Rich, I thank you for taking the time. A few things that you guys may not know about Rich, like I said 35 years in the industry, but it was more like you said 45-ish?
It's 40, no, not quite yet. 43 years.
43, again, I was wrong.
Yeah.
But you also, so you rep a lot of like high-end lines. We talked about doing Full Circle, how everything changes and nothing changes, or nothing changes and everything changes.
Yes.
Talked about analog going to digital and back to analog and hi-fi coming full circle. Back in what was that, 1980, you were you used to write for Mix magazine, is that correct?
Yeah, in 1980 I wrote a couple of articles for Mix magazine, and what I was trying to do was to bridge the gap between pro audio and consumer audio, because there seems to be a distrust between the pro audio community and the audiophile community.
Right.
Pro audio community thinks that, you know, consumers are idiots, and these audiophiles think that pro audio companies, all they care about is SPL, and they're idiots.
Right.
And so I wrote a couple of articles for Mix magazine trying to bridge that gap.
Yeah.
And it didn't work. And that gap probably is broader today than it was in 1980, you know? That was a couple of years ago. So,
yeah. You are also an active member of the AES.
I've been an active member of AES since 1972. And I attend probably 3 or 4 of their chapter meetings a year. You know, it's, I need to learn and I need to stay abreast, and I want to be aware of what's going on the production side as well as the reproduction side. That then gives me a, you know, a much better perspective. You know, that's why I like to go to CES. I go to AES when they're in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
But I go to CES not so much to see the high-end manufacturers, but to see the large-scale manufacturers that potentially will provide some really clever solutions into the CI space, you know, our space.
Yeah, right.
You know, and some of them, you know, it's not a real big market. And so a lot of these guys, like Logitech, you know, they discontinued the Harmony remote, which I thought was the coolest remote around.
Yeah.
I've got 3 Harmonies at home, and I go online and I have my profile, and, it's, you know, I can change things.
Discontinued, you know? They sold it, I think, right?
Think they may have sold it, because it was originally a Canadian company, and then Logitech acquired it, and I'm not sure what they did with it. They still support it.
But then I heard that, Yeah, I'm pretty sure they sold it off, but then I heard something about, yeah, it's still being supported and possibly someone else has it. I just can't remember the name right now, and it's slipping my
Well,
mind.
it's interesting because I recently bought a Oppo 103. I'm good friends with Jen and Jason down in Mountain View at Oppo Digital, and I
What?
went
At Oppo?
the Oppo. Yeah,
Yeah.
I love Oppo. It's a
They
great
make
company.
a beautiful,
They're
well, just an
very
excellent DVD player.
Apple-like. They really want to make sure their customer has a good experience.
A lot of people say it's a bit pricey for what you're getting, but it doesn't it support like almost every format? Like,
Yeah, well, it's scary because you look at the box, and the menu. Let's say the manufacturing cost of their basic player to play the shiny disc is $200.
okay.
There's another $250 that they have to pay in licensing. You look at all the logos. Every logo on that box is costing them $25 a box. So no, I mean, if in fact they want to bring a full complement, Amazon and some of the streaming services, Rhapsody doesn't provide their service for free.
Right.
There's a charge involved. So, but I'm very fond of companies like Oppo because they're in it for the right reason and they provide a good value and a great experience. They take good care of their customers. I'm a little sad that they don't have room really for dealers and reps.
Yeah.
But I still buy their product,
Yeah, that's good.
because I think it's the best value, and that's what I'm looking for.
It's an excellent player, yeah. Yeah, it's unfortunate that integrators and other, they won't open up, but, what are you gonna do?
Well, and it's interesting because I put the BDP 103 in my main system, and I went on the Logitech Model One site, and guess what? The codes were there. The player was already there. And I'm going, oh, that's cool, because the 103 was introduced after Logitech announced that they were getting out of the Model One business. So obviously they're keeping their databases current, which is good. That's the right thing to do. So.
Rich, you also represent James Loudspeaker, some stuff that I sell. I'm very, again, like I said, they are very well with design and quality products.
Great company, great solutions. I do Cords, which is an Australian manufacturer of HDMI cables.
I love their cables. They fit so nice. I think one of the biggest problems with HDMI is like I'll get a phone call saying, the DVD player doesn't work. I'm like, did you check to see if your HDMI cable is connected? And like, just make sure because it's an hour for me to drive out there, and I'll have to charge you when I have to go plug it in, and eventually, or inevitably, will be me plugging the HDMI cable that was loose or didn't, was unplugged.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Yeah, because HDMI have minimum and maximum specifications in terms of the amount of coding actually on the connector, and Cords is the only manufacturer that adheres to the maximum amount, so it's a tight fit on any TV or any AVR, so or processor. So.
Yeah, and they have flat cabling, and it's braided on some, depending on what line you end up
It's,
going
uh,
with. But
they're, they're, you know, they hired the guy for the United States is lives in Sunnyvale, and he was the compliance manager for HDMI. So, it's great to have a resource in this territory that isn't a sales guy that can tell me exactly what's about with HDMI, especially now HDMI has gone to 2.0, so there's some confusion. HDMI, like a lot of technologies, or like all technologies, is a moving target, and it's really nice to have an expert, that lives, within 25 miles of me, And last but not least, I also do Wisdom Audio, which is a magnetic planar type speaker, like MagnaPan, which is nice because it has very, very light diaphragms, and it moves air at the same time, so everything is perfectly phase coherent. And by having that type of large radiating surface, you have something that images incredibly well and provides depth of field. That's the toughest part to get in a high-end audio system. Left to right is pretty easy. Imaging to the center is pretty easy. But that third dimension, well, actually, there's four dimensions. There's front to back and top to bottom. And, those are the ones that you really pay a premium to get. Because theoretically, there's four dimensions that two loudspeakers can reproduce. So, anyway, it's always kind of an ongoing challenge to stay current. And, I get early generation Bryston DACs, and all of a sudden, a year later, they've got second generation DAC that, adds asynchronous USB and a couple of other features. So I find myself constantly, upgrading and buying new stuff. But it's okay, it's my passion and it's my profession. So I enjoy it.
Well, before we go, I want to thank Hypersign again. You guys, like I said, if you go to hypersign.com, you can check out all their digital signage solutions. And if you're in, or if you are a commercial integrator, that's something you should definitely be at least offering to your clients on some scale, because there's a huge market for that. So hypersign.com and Atlas Sound, who's been around forever, making racks, speakers, cables, amps, and a bunch of the stuff that we're putting together for everyone else to enjoy their homes and automated solutions.
And on Atlas Sound, don't forget they make microphone stands.
And microphone stands.
And I used to be an Atlas Sound dealer because we did a little bit of commercial. We sold Sennheiser microphones and Shure microphones. Mm-hmm. And we sold Atlas microphone stands. So that's a major category for them as well.
And they sell microphone stands, which I was unaware of. So I learned new item thing today. They are at atlassound.com. If you want to check out Rich or know a little more about him, feel free to go to his website, which is richjackson.com. It's richjackson.com. richjackson.com. There's bio right there when you get there, and you can check out his lines if you're in the Bay Area. I'm sure he reps at least one item that you're probably already selling. So if you're listening, you probably know him. If not, it's worth checking out. Rich, what is the best way for them to get a hold of you versus your website?
My phone number is listed. It's 510-523-8560.
Okay.
And my email is easy. I got my primary domain in 1997. It's probably the most valuable thing I own. And my email is rcj@rcj.com.
And
I have people like Intel is now opened up Intel Media, and their chief creative officer came down. He was interested in invisible speakers, and he wasn't able to find a dealer in the South Bay that would show them. So he and his wife came over a few Saturdays ago. So, I welcome anyone to contact me, and I want to be that first phone call. I don't represent everything, but, I have a pretty good understanding of what's out there, and I have no problem referring people to what the right solution would be, at least from my perspective.
Right. So if you're curious on, like I said, our topic was everything changes and nothing changes, because we talked about analog to digital to compressed to quality audio, again, back to analog. Rich has a really nice display of that kind of that whole whole categories, or several categories I should say, where you can experience hi-fi in a digital realm. And so if you want to have your iPod all by itself and with your little earbuds that they come with, and then listen to that same track on vinyl, I'm sure it's not that hard.
It's not, and I can step people through, and each step everyone universally will hear an improvement.
Right. So. It's a pretty nice system. I've been there several times, and there's a few different listening areas where you can experience some the difference, and it's plainly obvious.
And guess what? It's fun.
It is fun. I enjoy it very much, and I don't get down there as much as I want to, Rich, but I want to come down sometime and hang out.
And I'm very lucky because I've never had a real job. And
of course, that is a real job, man.
I have fun,
if you love what you do, I guess it's not really a real job, right?
No, and I get goosebumps,
Yeah, that's why I enjoy doing what I do, is because I'll never learn everything, because technology changes. Like we said, everything's changing, but at the same time, nothing's really changing. It all comes back.
Absolutely, and it's just it's a real kick.
Yeah.
So anyway. thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you for having the show, and maybe in a while we'll have you back on the show when we get some of your other guys, and we can kind of get back into it. I had a lot of fun, so thank you.
Okay,
we'll
good
definitely
deal.
Talk soon.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks, John.